Good morning. We'll give you guys a couple of minutes to get situated and get ready to go. Council's ready. We'll call the second case on our docket for oral argument this morning, which is Tamara Prince versus David L. Foreman, DBA J&D Contractors. And our clerk will announce counsel on the time they've requested.
May I please report, Mr. Art Brenner will argue for appellant for 15 minutes, and Mr. Bradley Dickinson will argue for appellee for 15 minutes.
Thank you. Mr. Brenner, you may proceed.
Please report. I'm representing Tamara Prince in the appeal of a wrongful death case resulted in a verdict for her children of negligence based on motor vehicle collision in which Mr. George Wesley Hare was driving his pickup truck in a construction zone, was apparently on his cell phone, was seen throwing something down, and his vehicle then left the roadway, crossed a series of cones, and struck Roderick Williams, killing him, and another gentleman, who were both highway employees working for a construction crew on the highway. Mr. Hare claimed that he had fallen asleep, although he denied loss of consciousness to the EMTs and to the police, and the jury rendered a verdict that he was negligent. The court submitted over our objection a question of a common law marriage of some 7 years between Tamara Prince and Roderick Williams, during which time they had two children and had been living together since 1999. Collision occurred in 2006. This proceeding was instituted initially by a Rule 202 motion to investigate the cause of the collision. And then in March of 2007, that was in December 2006, in March of 2007, Tamara Prince commenced an action in the probate court to declare her marriage, common law marriage, as required by Section 2.401 of the Family Code, and also to receive permission for attorneys to represent her children as required by the probate code, and, of course, to establish the right of her to bring a survivor action under the Wrongful Death Act. The end of June of 2007, that's right, the court declared her to be married, declared heirship after the appointment of an attorney ad litem to investigate claims, and then in September, find an order allowing counsel to proceed on her behalf and on behalf of her children. The court submitted the question of informal marriage. In fact, the case became somewhat a circus over just that issue. Then the jury ruled against her on the submission, and we moved for a new trial based on the fact that there had been no showing that she did not have standing to exert her claim as the wife of Roderick Williams.
I think the real question in my mind is, isn't this just purely an issue of collateral estoppel?
No.
Okay, why isn't it? Because it seems like if the appellee here, David Foreman, DBA, JD Contractors, was not a party to the litigation or to the heirship determination, how can that order from the probate court have preclusive effect in subsequent litigation?
Two ways. Well, first of all, one way. He was given notice. The notice that we filed, it's in the court's record starting at 722 and going through 764, is a complete record of the probate court.
If I said notice, I apologize. I meant participation in the litigation. I mean,
well,
if they had
I think all he has to have is he has that opportunity because he's given that notice by the probate code, as is every creditor of Roderick Williams or anybody else. The probate code shows, and they, I know they've raised that in their brief, and they claim, first of all, there's no evidence they didn't have notice, not a bit. Not one bit of testamentary evidence. They filed a motion in which they said they contended they didn't have notice. I don't believe that that's established by any sworn testimony in the case. But what I'm telling you is that in the probate filing, which was duly authenticated public record, pages 754, 755, and 756 and 57, it attests to the posting by citation, and by both by posting and by publication of the notice of the probate.
But for collateral estoppel to apply, I think they have to have participated in the litigation.
I agree, but that you don't need a collateral estoppel any more than you need to show anything more than your marriage certificate to show your standing to bring a wrongful death act. Your standing as a litigant in a wrongful death act is determined by the family code, and that's what the in the method of proving up a marriage as stated by and the Supreme Court clearly held in this Shepherd versus Ledford case. Same situation basically there, except that Ms. Ledford had not proven up her common law marriage until she filed a wrongful death action, and she was passed. At that time, there was a one-year statute of limitation. Realize what they had a hold in Ledford to get to the result that they did was that you use the family code to prove a marriage. And once your marriage is proven, that proof is your marriage certificate. It's just as if you had a marriage certificate on file at the county. You're married, and it's up to the defense. The only defense is that the marriage is void.
Distinction between a probate court order granting you standing to bring a lawsuit and establishing the fact, you know, litigating the fact of a common law marriage?
No, because that's what you have to do in the probate court. You have to do the exact same thing. And there's competing interests. That's why they appoint attorney ad litem to ensure that the children are not improperly denied their right to the estate by a claim of common law marriage that's not true. That's how you prove it. And that's what the statute says. I mean, the statute's pretty clear. It doesn't say this is a limitation statute, which is what they're trying to argue. It says quite clearly, in any judicial, administrative, or other proceeding, the marriage of a man and a woman may be proved by evidence that you can have filed a declaration or that they agreed to be married, and after that agreement they lived together in this state as husband and wife, and they were represented to each other that they were married. And what the Supreme Court clearly says is this, Mrs. Ledford did not have to file her medical liability claim within 1 year of Mr. Ledford's death. Rather, she only had to initiate a proceeding to prove the prerequisite elements of an informal marriage within 1 year of his death. And at that time, the section of the family code was section 1.91 A and B. Now it's 2.401. There are legal procedures available for common law spouses in Mrs. Ledford's situation. For example, Mrs. Ledford could have filed a proceeding to declare heirship to establish the existence of her common law marriage, see probate code section 48A, or she could have filed the wrongful death claim within 1 year of Mr. Ledford's death and established the existence of common law marriage at trial. The choice was hers as long as she initiated a proceeding to prove her common law marriage within 1 year of the time limit. And in fact, in this Nava case I've cited versus Ready Properties, she filed a Social Security claim. And that was sufficient. That was a summary judgment case. But your creditors don't have a right to come in and claim that your marriage wasn't consummated or that it really wasn't a loving marriage. They only have a right to show that your marriage is void, and this is what they haven't done. Once you prove it, and you can prove it any one of those ways, it says in any judicial, administrative, or other proceeding.
But in Nava and Ledford, was the subsequent claim that the spouse was attempting to prove the common law marriage in order to obtain, was it a wrongful death suit?
Nava, they're all wrongful death suits because they're all after the fact. I mean, I believe in Nava, her husband was killed in a, if I'm not mistaken, it was in a, the apartment, he was murdered in an apartment complex, at the Chase Apartments. And what she did is commence an application for widow benefits with Social Security Administration the month after he died, and then commenced to proceed to establish her common law marriage within 1 year as required by Section 1.91. Then later on, after the 1 year, she filed suit for wrongful death against the apartment complex, thrown out on summary judgment. This is the, I believe it's the Houston court, if I'm not mistaken. This basically following Shepard, 1999, first district in Houston. And there's others. You don't realize in Shepard, too, the court goes on to distinguish this Mosler versus Shields case, where they had where a woman filed for divorce and the divorce was denied, and then she went in and tried to prove the common law marriage, and the court said no, you had that attempt to prove that your common law marriage can't be proven after that limitation. In other words, that's how you prove a common law marriage. Marriage is a product of statute, and now by constitution, somewhat in under our constitutional provision, but the only way you could do it, and the only attack is on standing. If, for instance, they cite this Phillips versus Dow case, in that case, the court once again upheld the family code as a way of proving marriage. What they said was, though, in that in the Phillips versus Dow, there was an impediment to the marriage because the proponent of the marriage, who was attempting to file the wrongful death case, admitted that he'd been married before, but he'd been divorced before the common law relationship began. They then produced evidence that the divorce didn't occur, it wasn't final, until after this common law spouse had actually died. So once again, they threw him out on summary judgment because there was a legal impediment to the marriage. Age could be a legal impediment. Any of those that prevent you from claiming marriage. But you can't go into the aspect of the marriage any more than you can if it's ceremonial marriage. Because what this does is establish a ceremonial marriage, in essence. In other words, the family code establishes marriage either by a ceremonial marriage with a properly filed license, or a declaration, which you can now do under the statute, or you can prove it up this way in any proceeding. Once you've done that, it's as if you have the marriage certificate. And then the only thing that you can do from there is, if you're opposing it some way, is show that it was entered into fraudulently. Anything that would void a marriage, but that's not what they did here. They attempted to go into the marriage itself and says it really wasn't a common law marriage. In other words, relitigate what she'd already litigated in the probate court. Now it so happens it wouldn't necessarily be that way because you might enter into it and then establish the marriage and then file your wrongful death case way down the line. In this case, they had all kinds of opportunity if they wanted to come in and contest it as a creditor, as a proposed creditor, because we had amended our petition before there was ever a final hearing in the probate case.
I'm sure you know that the Supreme Court's holding in Shepard was overruled a couple of times last year in that Lovato, I think, nursing home case, and another case where the Supreme Court basically held that you do not have to get an heirship determination before you have standing to bring a wrongful death action. And I'm wondering if working backwards that has any implication on this case.
I don't think it does because I don't think it affects the question of the common law marriage situation. I think they were dealing more with once again, there's several different aspects to Shepard as far as that goes. I don't believe it affects the common law marriage and the fact that they hold quite clearly that this is how you prove a common law marriage. And like I said, it's not just a limitation. If it was just a limitation statute, they would have used, in other words, if you didn't apply the Family Code to the Wrongful Death Act, as they're trying to argue, then you would have applied, as they clearly say, the Wrongful Death Statute of Limitation. Depending upon what, it's a 2-year or 4-year, could be more, depending upon the survival and the wrongful death and that sort of thing. But but they clearly say that. They say you've got 1604, if I'm not mistaken. 1603 is the limitation provision of the Wrongful Death Act, and they disregard that as they do the all powerful limitation in the medical liability insurance liability protective act, whatever. I get the terms mixed up, but they basically accept the family code because I think what they're saying is that's how you establish marriage. Once you've established it, no matter what proceeding, even if it's in a Social Security hearing, then the only defense to it is, just like I said, there's no defense to the fact that I can have a marriage license, as you know, and maybe not be, maybe I'm Tiger Woods or something. I might not be a very good husband. I might not actually have a marriage of convenience. I might have a marriage which was never consummated. I might have all those things. You don't go behind the marriage license. If you have the marriage license in a wrongful death action, it establishes that. And the only way to do it, the only way to undo it, is if there's some impediment to it that somehow voided that marriage. I think that's why they did it like this. And the court talks about in that Ross case the contentions over whether they should or shouldn't have common law marriage, and apparently this legislature not only opted for it, but they codified it. So we now have a codification of those prior principles. But even before we had the codification, common law marriage was subject to the statutory provisions, having to do with whether you could, whether you had a right to, you had statutory provisions regarding the fact that there had to be a man and a woman, the fact that you had to be of a certain age, all those sorts of things applied to common law marriage. But now common law marriage is a statute, and I think the Shepherd case clearly adopts it as their method and the only method, and once again followed by Nava, followed by there's another one where they filed suit for divorce in divorce petition before the death of the proponent. There was an admission that there was a marriage, and they said that was sufficient to establish
counsel,
that standing. So
your time's expired, but
time's up.
We'll hear you again on rebuttal.
I'll get out of the way.
Good morning. May I please the court, counsel? My name is Brad Dickinson. I am appellate counsel for the appellees in this case. This case involves one primary issue, and that is a probate court determination of the existence of a common law marriage conclusive and binding under any circumstances in a subsequent wrongful death action filed in district court? We believe that Texas law on that is very clear. The answer is no. That is a matter that is to be determined in the wrongful death and in the district court action. Before I address it, I'd like to point out a couple of things that are kind of nuanced in this appeal. First of all, there has been no challenge whatsoever to the sufficiency of the evidence to support the jury's determination that there was not a common law marriage. It's not in their briefs. They've not challenged it. There was no, there's no ruling. That stands. The second issue is basically what the proper standard of review is. Ms. Prince's counsel has taken the position this is purely a de novo issue, a matter of statutory interpretation. We do not necessarily agree, depending upon how the issue is phrased. If the question is simply, is a prior probate court ruling always binding, then it may be a statutory issue, and then it is de novo review. However, we believe, and I believe the question was addressed by Justice Walker earlier, isn't this really a collateral estoppel issue? We believe that is the case, that this is really a matter of should that probate court determination collaterally estop litigation of the issue in the district court action. Under those circumstances, the standard of review would be an abuse of discretion standard. We cited the cases in our brief on that because that would involve a mixed question of law and fact that would have been for resolution by the trial court. First of all, with regard to their complaint, they say that Section 2.401 sets forth the parameters for determination of a common law marriage and that no one, neither the district court, adverse parties, or the jury may challenge that regardless of the circumstances under which that was taken. Don't want to go into too much of the notice at this point. Fact is, if they are claiming offensive collateral estoppel, which they essentially are, the burden is on them to establish the elements of that. And there is nothing in this record that shows that we had any notice other than their vague reference to a publication that there was a probate proceeding going on. There was nothing to show that we had knowledge of a common law marital issue being presented to the probate court and that we had any participation in it because they did not. Now, they have cited the three cases, the Shepherd versus Ledford case, as well as the JCPenney and the Nava cases. Those three cases are consistent because they all hold the same thing, limitations. Shepherd involved the question of whether or not you had to file within 1 year under Section 1.91 of the Family Code, or whether you could use the two-year statute of limitations. And the court said no, simply you must, pursuant to this statute, if you're going to claim a common law marriage, you must initiate some judicial, administrative, or other proceeding within 1 year. The Supreme Court never said in that case that, and it did not even address, whether a probate court determination or any other proceeding would have been binding. In fact, if you go to the Nava case that they discussed, that involved a woman whose husband was murdered. Within a month, she filed a claim for Social Security benefits. The Court of Appeals held that was instituting a proceeding within the meaning of Section 1.91 such that you were allowed to subsequently file a wrongful death action. There is nothing in that case that remotely even infers that the filing of a Social Security claim would be binding on a district court in Texas in a wrongful death action, saying that, yes, you are the common law spouse because a Social Security Administration caseworker came to the conclusion that it was a common law marriage. Excuse me. Similarly, in the J.C. Penney case that they rely upon, that was a case in which a man and woman had lived together, held themselves out as husband and wife, filed joint tax returns, had children, and then separated. He then filed a divorce proceeding in which he claimed they were married. During the pendency of that, he died. The alleged common law spouse said, I'm entitled to the life insurance proceeds. And the court said, the mere filing of the divorce action implies the existence of a common law marriage, and thus that was sufficient. All three of those cases stand for the timeliness, the limitations issue, and that is the purpose of that statute that they are relying upon. Because taking the tragic facts of this accident, let's say Ms. Prince and Mr. Williams had ceased seeing each other 3 years ago, and in 5 years, he's killed. He dies in an accident. What that statute says is 5 years from now, you could not come back and claim there was a common law marriage. You had to do it under 1.191 within 1 year and under 2.401 within 2 years. There is a legitimate public interest in saying if you were going to claim the existence of an informal marriage, then you have to do it within a certain time period. Conversely, the cases that we've cited go directly to the issue. And very importantly, in the Garza versus Maverick case, they've tried to distinguish these cases, Garza versus Maverick and Brown versus Edwards, by saying, well, that dealt with paternity. Well, there's not a lot of difference between the paternity establishment under the Family Code and common law marriage. I mean, they are two code sections that, as the courts in those cases stated, they were not designed to address tort actions. And specifically what the court said in the Garza versus Maverick case was, and that dealt with a probate court determination, or excuse me, Buster dealt with it, but the other one did also. What they said is the class of persons entitled to sue on the Wrongful Death Act are to be determined in the wrongful death case and not in the probate action. They then continue to explain why the probate court is designed to have a comprehensive system for distribution of property and not a means of identifying wrongful death beneficiaries. If you take the Brown and the Garza case, they both say you do not supplant the Wrongful Death Act with the Family Code or the probate court. In the Buster case, which they have attempted to distinguish, it is very, very similar. In fact, Buster and Phillips are very, very similar factually to what we have in this case. In Buster, his alleged common law spouse was killed in an accident. A defendant admitted liability. Buster went to the probate court, as did his alleged common law spouse's mother, claiming to be the sole heir. The probate court held that he was the common law husband. He then filed a wrongful death act. There wasn't a question of limitations like there is in the cases that were relied upon by Ms. Prince's counsel. In fact, they said the sole issue was whether a judgment by the probate court precluded defendant from litigating or contesting the issue of the existence of a common law marriage. First of all, the court went through the collateral estoppel factors and noted that defendant was not a party to the case, thus it couldn't have been binding, but they then expressly rejected the contention they're making in this case and stated that the probate court was not the proper forum for determining the wrongful death beneficiary. They did the same thing in the Phillips case. It was the Galveston probate court, entered a determination of heirship, and in that case, there was the defendant who came in and challenged it. And they stated in that case that although the probate court declared that they were common law married, neither the trial court nor the defendants were bound by that determination. It had to be made under the separate facts. And the logic and policy behind that, and I'm not saying it happened in this case, but the reason they have that is to prevent somebody from years later coming in and saying, oh, well, I was the common law spouse, or having family and friends come into a court and say, we want a determination of common law spouse. There is no question that it was in the best interest of Ms. Prince and in the best interest of her and Mr. Williams' children to have that determination. But it is not binding when you, on the district court or on the jury in a wrongful death action, when they're entitled to consider numerous other things that were not presented to the probate court. Do not have to go through all the factual differences because that has not been challenged, but let's just say that there was a plethora of evidence to support the jury's determination, from tax records to employment records to documentation filled out by the parties stating they were single to questions on the living arrangements that all supported the jury's determination in this.
Mr. Dickinson.
Yes, sir.
What pleading raises the issue of common law marriage? What pleading?
There was an answer with a verified answer stating that Ms. Prince, in which they denied that Ms. Prince was the surviving spouse.
And was there in that answer any mention of any kind of estoppel?
Of our estoppel?
Were there any pleadings raised by the defense that in any way raised the issue of estoppel?
If I understand your question correctly, Your Honor, no. We did not raise estoppel, nor did they. I believe that that burden and the case law on that, if I'm understanding the question correctly, is the burden on estoppel would have been on Ms. Prince.
And I understand that.
Okay.
I'm interested in what pleadings raised the issue of estoppel in order for us to go with your discussion of the proper standard of review to be applied in this court.
I apologize. Now, to my knowledge, it was never raised.
In the trial court.
They never came in and said collateral stop, but I will admit that it was discussed.
Right.
And I think that the trial court was saying they were not a party to it.
So the source of the issue that was submitted to the jury in terms of pleading was the verified answer of the defendants in the case.
Yes, in which we disputed her status as the wife of Roderick Williams.
In the answer,
yes.
And there wasn't any other pleadings filed by the defense other than that answer that in any way attacked the validity or existence of a common law marriage.
Oh, no. Well, no, there was. They filed a notice of marriage and a motion in limine in which they sought to exclude any evidence of the defense evidence regarding the fact that there was not a common law marriage. The defense responded to that, trial counsel responded to that with a brief in opposition to their motion in limine in which the defense argued we did not have knowledge of this, we are not bound by it, presented the court with many of the cases that we've cited stating this is an issue for resolution by the trial court. I mean, there was those pleadings as well. It was brought to the attention of the court in a motion in limine and a response, and the trial court entered an order stating that the issue would be submitted to the jury.
Thank you, sir.
Oh, thank you. The final issue, and I'll just take a minute on it, and deals with the new trial. The question of the new trial and maybe I misunderstood Mr. Brender's comments, the issue in the new trial dealt with whether or not it was an abuse of discretion to not grant a new trial because there was one mention of the fact that Ms. Prince also had claimed that Ballou Construction, the employer, was negligent or grossly negligent. That is all that was said. I bring that up because there is no possible way, first of all, under the findings in this case, that that could have been harmful, regardless of what they say. The only adverse liability finding to Ms. Prince was on the existence of common law marriage. Nothing to do with liability. All that was stated was, plaintiffs further claim that Blue Construction negligently and with gross negligence. At that point, the inquiry ended. I will acknowledge, as I think I did in my brief, that should not have been said by trial counsel. But it was not harmful under the facts of this case, because that would only go to liability. There was no evidence of any settlement, no evidence that she'd received any other money from Blue Construction Company. Nothing else was presented on that, and it could not possibly have been reversible error. The second thing on that is that in order to object to that and preserve error, they were required to not only object, which they did, but then also request an instruction in mistrial, which is set forth in our brief. They did not.
I have a question concerning the third issue. If the first issue is resolved, the first two issues were resolved the way that you propose that they should be, is it necessary for us to reach the third issue?
No, it is not. If, in fact, the jury, or if, in fact, the trial court was not bound by the probate court determination, all inquiries end at that point. And I see my time's almost over unless anyone has any other questions.
Other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Brender, can you hold on for one second? Ken, I believe Ms. Bush left her purse there, and I believe they have been looking to come get it. Pardon me?
No, I said it's not mine.
Yes. I thought you said it was yours, and I was thinking, oh, goodness, I've committed a social faux pas. Thank you, Ken. And one other thing. Mr. Marsden, I'm sorry, I've just now realized I mispronounced your name during argument, so I wanted to apologize for that. Okay. Now, Mr. Brender, rebuttal.
I'll run it, Judge. Let me mention one thing about that last. It was egregious in the way a lot of things were egregious in that trial. There had been motions in limine argued about not bringing that up. They claim that they admitted negligence. They never did. In fact, they denied it. Only in oral argument did they finally get in and say we were negligent. But then when they were told not to bring it up, they specifically brought it up. Why? Because when you look at the evidence, he says there's abundance. Not so. There's nothing but a loving relationship with these two people who went to church together, who had two children together. What they did was they were filing separate tax returns, and they went into all that stuff and made a big deal to make her look like she was greedy. And that's why they did that, to say, look, she got something else. She already got some money over here, and that's why they introduced it. The judge chewed them out real good. He denied the mistrial. He should have granted it because it was egregious. That's all the trial was about. Look at it. 3 pages of nothing but her tax returns, the fact that they moved from one apartment to another, and things like that. Nothing about the fact that they took care of these kids. The kids had good grades in school, and all that sort of thing. That's the atrocity that was committed in this case. It really was, and it should never have been. And if you go into all that stuff, then we couldn't, because we weren't even allowed to put into evidence the investigation by the ad litem in the probate proceeding. I mean, if you're going to ignore it, Coley, what you're going to do is just what you've done here. We've got a verdict that doesn't make sense. We've got a state that's established one way under the Survivor Act, and then we've got a different finding on the marital relationship. You can't do that. That's not what these statutes were meant to do. They were meant to make one concise way of proving marriage under the family code. After that, he tries to set this up by saying, under any circumstances. I didn't say that. There are circumstances in which you can disprove it. The Dow case is one. If you could show that marriage isn't capable. But what you can't do is what they were allowed to do here, and then to take a very horrible, horrible collision in which a guy basically intentionally ran over a bunch of people because he was mad at his girlfriend, whatever, when he threw his cell phone down, and allow that to become a circus over whether or not somebody's tax return was this and that and whatever, and whether they were claiming both them and this and all that kind of stuff. And so when you get into that, That's why you don't get to go into whether the marriage is a valid marriage, whether it's a good marriage, bad marriage, or whatever. If they're married, they're married. When you're married, whether you get a certificate out of the probate court or whether you get a certificate at the clerk's office, you're married. If they can show you're not eligible.
Isn't there a distinction because even though we may agree with you on all of the facts, nonetheless, the issue is really whether the probate court order was binding. And isn't there a distinction between a marriage license and a probate proceeding as far as collateral estoppel? I mean, collateral estoppel only applies to prior litigation. And yeah. So while a marriage license might be conclusive of a fact, to have an order from a court be conclusive in another proceeding, how can we get around the application of collateral estoppel?
Well, because I don't think collateral estoppel applies any more than it does if I had a marriage certificate. That establishes my marriage. Whether I prove it over here in by the way, they go into great length in the Nava case to say that, you know, Social Security had to actually follow Texas law, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to comply with Texas law, but once you have that, you don't have to collaterally estop somebody that once they have it, they have the marriage certificate, then it's a question of standing. And by the way, Your Honor, I objected to the fact that their pleading said that they were married, that she was married to her son. They ignored that, I think, arrogantly. The court just said, "I'm going to overrule it," but they don't have a pleading to raise that. I don't believe they never had, and they don't have any evidence.
Rendered, yeah. Was there on the part of the plaintiff ever any pleadings that raised before the court any issue of estoppel?
Not in terms of collateral estoppel, but in terms of, yes, in terms of the filing of the notice of the of marriage and the motion in limine, in which we asked that they prohibit that issue is off the table. I guess you could say that was an estoppel. I don't know that I used the term estoppel in that notice. I think what I said was.
Your position, nonetheless, is that the statute in the Family Code establishing the manner for arriving at a common law marriage is dominant in later proceedings that involve wrongful death.
I think the answer to that is yes. I think I think you could say the plaintiff's notice of marriage, 722 of the record, in which we said we presume it to be valid, and we cite the section of the Family Code 1.101, 2.4. She was properly married by virtue of an informal marriage, which was properly and duly proven and authenticated pursuant to the procedures set forth in section 2.401 of the Texas Family Code. And then I attach this. That was in combination with the motion in limine saying you cannot therefore raise any issue unless you raise an issue as to the voidness of the marriage.
Thank you, sir.
I think that establishes that we certainly put it this way. The court was on notice. This was like a couple of different hearings we had on this, in which unfortunately they weren't reported, but the orders were entered, and I think the notice was correct. I think I'm out of time. Once again, pardon me for going over two or three times, but appreciate it. And we move the court to grant a new trial based on the evidence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments here today. We appreciate them. Your case is submitted, and our clerk will adjourn court.